Well, we're going to get started. Thank you, everybody, for coming to our session, Define It, Design It, Do It. I'm Geeta Ramprasad, and I'm here to moderate and to contribute somewhat about community action models to address disparities, promote health, and create positive social experiences in diverse communities. First, we have to say that none of us have any relationships to disclose. And here's what our agenda looks like. I'm going to do the welcome, and introductions. And then I'm also going to talk about give an overview of our public health problem. The public health problem that we're focused on is obesity. And so I'll talk a little bit about the problem nationally and then relate it to New Orleans, too. And then we're going to go into our esteemed panelists' presentations. There's going to be a presentation on tools to improve physical activity, a presentation on campaigns, walking paths, and walking clubs, and another presentation on strategic partnerships and walking programs. And then finally, we'll wrap it up, summarize, and then take questions and comments from the rest of you. So thanks again. Like I said, I'm Geeta. I'm a native of Chicago, came from the Windy City to another Windy City. and I have worked on health equity initiatives and to promote health, to prevent disease, and to provide access to medical services for low-income, vulnerable populations in the Midwest. I also have a background in law, and I worked primarily my practice is with healthcare transactions, and I focus on physicians and hospitals for my client base. Dr. Adam Becker is also from Chicago, or lives and works in Chicago. I'm not sure if you're from Chicago. Okay. and he is the interim co-director of the Marianne and J. Milburn Smith Child Health Research Program at the Children's Hospital of Chicago Research Center. He's an associate professor of pediatrics and preventive medicine at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and executive director of the Consortium to Lower Obesity in Chicago Children. CLOC is a nationally recognized organization with a coordinated multi-sector and multi-level approach to preventing childhood obesity. Dr. Becker received his Master of Public Health in 1994 and his PhD in 1999, both in health behavior and health education from the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He went to Tufts University for his BA. He has extensive training and experience in the practice of community-based participatory research and has written a number of book chapters and articles on this approach to examining and addressing public health problems. He was a member of the faculty for 6 years at Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine and taught courses in community organizing, qualitative methods, and CBPR, program evaluation and community change strategies. Prior to becoming the executive director of CLOC, Dr. Becker was a director of evaluation and research at the Louisiana Public Health Institute in New Orleans. Welcome, Dr. Becker. Phil Quipoco is the American Heart Association's Health Equity Director for the Northern Illinois, Southeast Wisconsin, and Northwest Indiana territories. After 13 years with the American Heart Association, Phil can count many victories that advance community health. These include support for passing the Clean Indoor Act in Chicago, the Colleen O'Sullivan Law mandating automated external defibrillators in locations of high cardiac exertion, and funding for CPR in schools in Chicago Public Schools. Phil continues to work closely with a network of volunteers and alliance partners to advocate for Latino health issues. He's a champion of Latino initiatives within the health equity field at local, regional, and national levels and has established several successful alliances, including Sigma Delta Theta, Consulate General of Mexico, and the Illinois Hispanic Nurses Association. Phil is a recipient of the American Heart Association's Midwest Affiliate Outstanding Health Strategy Award and received the Hispanic Center of Excellence Award from the University of Illinois Chicago in 2012. In 2013, Phil was awarded the American Heart Association's prestigious Rome Betts Award, and this national award recognizes outstanding staff members for their leadership, professionalism, and dedication. Phil's goal is to continue to grow community awareness related to cardiovascular disease and stroke and to increase the number of participants engaged in this life-saving effort. And Phil and I have worked closely for several years now on his Multicultural Leadership Committee in Chicago, and so we have quite a rich background together on vulnerable populations and health equity. Scott is an urban planner who currently serves as the Healthy Places Program Coordinator at Columbus Public Health. In this role, he works closely with other agencies on land use and transportation planning efforts to ensure that health considerations are addressed through a health in all policies approach. Ooh, that's next year's theme, too. So I'm sure we'll see you back. In addition, he oversees programs that conduct walkability assessments through the city and encourage more residents to walk and bike. Scott is a regular speaker at national, regional, and local conferences on healthy community design strategies and has a passion for urban design and placemaking for people and has several years of experience in community planning, active transportation, public space, parks, and conservation while working for the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. He holds a Master of City and Regional Planning degree from The Ohio State University, is a member of the American Institute of Certified Planners, and an accredited member of the Congress for New Urbanism. So welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining me on this panel. As I mentioned, I'll go over some stats and some, I guess probably everybody here is aware of the obesity crisis in our nation, but this is really what we have in common. We're all working to get people to lead healthier lives and by promoting better nutrition and more active lifestyles. Obesity is common, it's serious, and it's costly. From the CDC's most recent website stats, over a third of our Americans are obese. That doesn't mean overweight, obese. And obesity-related conditions can include type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and even cancer. When we look at obesity and overweight, over two-thirds of the American population are overweight and obese. And BMIs for overweight are 25 to 29.9, and BMIs to be considered obese are 30 and above. It's estimated that obesity-related conditions cost over $150 billion to our healthcare system, and medical expenses for people who are obese are on average about $1,500 higher per year than a non-obese person. And obesity hits some groups very, very hard. Non-Hispanic blacks are almost 50%. Obesity rate in non-Hispanic blacks and Hispanics about 43%. Poor and uneducated women are also disproportionately affected by the condition. Childhood obesity is also common and serious and costly. 17% of children ages 2 to 19 are obese, and they are often manifesting adult diseases now with type 2 diabetes and high cholesterol and high blood pressure. And this is in childhood. Often I've heard of physicians that see kids and treat kids for type 2 diabetes at 5 and 6 years old now. And childhood obesity also disproportionately affects Hispanics and blacks and uneducated households. And the low-income populations, especially among preschoolers. It seems that preschoolers who come from low-income backgrounds have a high disparity rate. But we also know that obesity is a preventive and controllable condition, and so we choose to look at it with a positive outlook and to encourage better eating habits and increased physical activity and promote food and physical activity environments and also strategic partnerships because, as I like to say, strength in numbers. I mean, it's easier to get people together around a shared vision and working together to make progress quicker. And I think in this case, we don't have any time to lose. So in coming to New Orleans, I looked up a few statistics on what this city is facing, and New Orleans' obesity rate is higher than the national rate. It's about 4%, 4 or 5% higher than the national rate. There's been a lot of talk in New Orleans, I guess, to try to figure out a way to deal with this situation. And there have been city leaders that are committed to fixing the problem, but nonetheless, it remains a problem. I think there's over 12% of adults in New Orleans have diabetes, which is pretty significant. And I can say that since I got here, I haven't stopped eating, so it is very, very tempting and very, very hard to discipline yourself around food. But that's why we're here, to talk about physical activity, because I just can't get away from that food. But we can walk, and I did notice that in talking to a few people at the hotel and the cab drivers, that what they consider too far to walk is, to me, I don't know, the blocks are a lot smaller here than in Chicago, and people just don't want to walk. So anyways, hopefully by the end of our panel here, we'll all want to get up and move while we eat our pralines. So anyway, I want to bring up Dr. Becker to talk about the what his organization CLOCK does, and in terms of empowering diverse communities and using evidence-based methods to build better blocks. So, Dr. Becker.
Thanks, Gita, and thanks everybody for being here. Time myself, see how I do. I'm Adam Becker. I'm the executive director of the Consortium to Lower Obesity in Chicago Children. I just want to share a little bit about CLOCK. We are a program of the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago, which used to be Children's Memorial Hospital, one of the few remaining freestanding children's hospitals in the country. CLOCK is a national model for comprehensive childhood obesity prevention. We've been recognized formally by the Centers for Disease Control, the Institute of Medicine, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the U.S. Surgeon General as a model to emulate and adapt. Our consortium is comprised of over 1,300 organizations, the majority of which are in Chicago, but we have many across the state, around the nation. And I was visited a couple of years ago by the Minister of Sport for Scotland, who was interested in borrowing some of our approaches. So we're very proud of how widespread our influence has become. We're data-driven and evidence-based, meaning that we follow where the data say we ought to be focusing and try to implement evidence-based best practices. We're focused as an organization on building capacity among all of our partners so that they can implement best practice approaches and be as successful as possible. We work at the national, state, and city levels, as well as in Chicago neighborhoods, where our focus is primarily in those neighborhoods that experience disparities in childhood obesity or social inequalities in general, where we don't know much about the actual data. Areas of focus for our organization and the consortium include food and beverage access, physical activity in the built environment, which I'll talk about today, policy and advocacy, which is, of course, related. We have a focus in early childhood, so an active stream of effort and research and evaluation and building capacity among our partners to conduct evaluation, health education and healthy lifestyle message promotioning, a focus on industry practices and school systems as well. We take what's called an ecological approach to addressing childhood obesity, so we look at all risk and protective factors at all levels of social organization. The black circle there, which you can't see, is the individual cellular or individual. We're located in a hospital, so we do think about the cellular sort of organic elements, but also individual, meaning knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors of kids. When you talk about kids, you have to think about family, family dynamics, family resources, family culture, and families will tell you often in the communities where we work in Chicago that the issues, the barriers to physical activity and healthy eating are by and large in their communities around access and the way the environment is shaped and built. And then, of course, societal level factors, policies, laws that shape conditions at the community level, family, et cetera. So today I'm going to focus on, like I said, physical activity in the built environment in that green circle community. So just a few things we know about factors that influence level of physical activities in neighborhoods. Walkability, which is really what I'm going to focus on today, meaning having safe and walkable sidewalks and streets, as well as pedestrian conveniences so that walking isn't a huge burden. Aesthetics, so attractiveness, cleanliness, and visual appeal of your surroundings, encourage walking. Ease of access to facilities and spaces like parks, indoor and outdoor recreation facilities, so if there's nowhere to walk to, why would you walk? And obviously safety. And that's safety both from traffic and from other people. Factors that discourage walking, sort of the opposite of the previous slide, lack of attractiveness and poor safety conditions. Primarily in urban neighborhoods, we see a lot of this, and we know that this is a major factor that inhibits physical activity in a lot of the neighborhoods that we work in. And these are just some images that show some examples of what many Chicago neighborhoods face, and probably many of the neighborhoods that you all are connected to as well. Other factors, a lack of public recreation facilities within or near a neighborhood. This picture on the left here is of the very beautiful walking and biking pathway along Lake Michigan in Chicago, but it's all the way on the east side of the city, and most of the lower income communities in Chicago are all the way on the west or south side, so they have very limited access physically, but also culturally. It doesn't feel like a space where lower-income, racial and ethnic minority community members can often be. I mean, there's obviously exceptions to that, but this is right. This stretch of it right here is going through what's called the Gold Coast, so very high-end, wealthy income housing, et cetera. So the lakeshore is there, but it's not really there or perceived to be there for everybody. A lack of variety of destinations within walking distance and traffic density. Other factors, and this one we learn more and more about as we do the work that I'm going to describe to you. Feeling unsafe may reduce confidence in one's ability to be more physically active, and this is true for both men and women. And just some data that we have about walking and perceptions of safety. This is from a study by Bennett et al. And you see here that we have sort of a inverse relationship, or, the less safe you feel, the less walking you do as measured by accelerometers. So CLOC, in an effort to kind of build capacity among our community organizational partners in neighborhoods and follow our kind of data-driven, evidence-based approach, we wanted to do something that helped neighborhoods to really identify the obstacles to walking and biking in their communities and have it be something that could be empirically discovered, if you will, and not just something that people knew intrinsically, which certainly they did. But it's a lot harder to influence change when you're just sort of coming with a story about a day in your life. Certainly for policymakers, they like to see numbers and what they call quote-unquote hard data. So our Neighborhood Walkability Initiative begins with what we call our Neighborhood Walkability Assessment Tool to help neighborhoods assess the safety and conditions of neighborhood walking routes. We engage participants in discussion of their findings, so they basically walk on a block or a series of blocks, wherever they want to identify obstacles, and I'll go a little bit more into the tool itself. And then after they've collected their data and identified obstacles to walking and biking, then we engage participants in a discussion of their findings, where they look at common obstacles that emerge. So often they'll have teams that go out onto different parts of the neighborhood, different blocks. They'll come back together and share what they saw. The sort of more common obstacles rise to the top. Then we work with them to prioritize those obstacles, the things they want to reduce, and the protective factors or influential factors that they want to actually enhance. And then from there, we work with them to develop and implement an action plan to address their priorities that they identified. So what's in the Neighborhood Walkability Assessment Tool? There are two parts. The first part is the data gathering component, and it's broken out into intersections and crosswalks and sidewalks and blocks. So there's a piece that's just for intersections with a separate set of instructions, and then a piece for the block, a separate set of instructions there. They look as they're kind of walking up and down the block or standing in an intersection. They're looking at traffic and pedestrian behavior, as well as the kind of environmental structures or lack thereof, appearances and perceptions that they have standing there or trying to walk there. The second part then links the obstacles to sort of a series of informative pieces, if you will. So one is called facts and rights. So we go into issues around, so for each sort of set of obstacles, there are examples of kind of what the facts are, what we know about Chicago environment, and the rights, pedestrian rights, right-of-way laws, those kinds of things, and show how they're their identified environments actually line up with what's, you know, legally supposed to be there. And then we break down into solutions. So we have two sets of solutions. They're really shorter term and longer term, but we call them actions we can take and actions we can request. So when you're thinking about obstacles to walking and biking, you could imagine a short-term thing. Like, let's say people say, well, this intersection, people speed through it, or, you know, they don't really pay attention to the stop sign, not even a rolling stop. They just kind of, you know, slow down and then barrel through. So a short-term solution might be to have neighborhood residents stand at that intersection at key times with signs that say, kids are walking, please slow down. And a longer-term action we can request might be to actually change the stop sign to a stop light, or do some traffic calming, or have the police monitor there for traffic violations. So they use this sort of set of information and the potential solutions to then prioritize issues and come to consensus on what they want to do. When it comes to prioritizing their problems, we ask them to think about a number of factors. How dangerous is the problem that they're looking at? What are the consequences if we don't address the issue? How many people does this affect in their community? And how easy is it to fix the problem? So those are some of the things we ask them to think about as they're trying to prioritize. We also ask them to kind of think through this grid here, so the criteria are importance of the issue, cost of fixing it, the time it might take, the support that might exist for addressing the problem, and then the feasibility of the solutions that they're coming up with. And then they rank them, they give it a score of a 5, a 3, or a 1 based on kind of where in the cell it fits. So something, a problem that's really important, but would get a 5 on importance. If it's really costly, it would get a 1. If it takes very little time, it would get a 5. If they think that people wouldn't be very supportive of the change, it gets a 1 for support. And if it's really easy to do, it would get a 5 for feasibility. And so they kind of rank them like that, and typically the ones that sort of score the highest are the ones they decide to go after first. We then help them develop an action plan. This is very basic. You probably all have seen, or maybe even have more technically graceful plans than what we use, but it's basically, you know, you come up with an action, lay out what the steps are to accomplish that action, who's going to do what and by when, and it kind of helps the community group to sort of stay on task for addressing the problem. Some of the things that have happened as a result of neighborhoods using the tool, folks have used our Neighborhood Walkability Initiative to get lights replaced in a dark underpass. In Chicago, we have a lot of these viaducts, so trains that go above and cars that drive under, and they're often kind of a refuge for criminal activity. Crime and violence happens there. A lot of homeless individuals in Chicago camp out under them. So they represent some serious obstacles to walking and biking in neighborhoods. One organization used their data to get wheelchair access improved on sidewalks around the school in their neighborhood. They've used it to get older missing speed limit signs replaced, crosswalks repainted. This is one of the most common results that happen as a result of communities going through this. Finished construction of a sidewalk next to a neighborhood park. There was a community-based organization that had been working on trying to get their sidewalks finished for the better part of 10 years. And when they finally had walkability data and could go to their city council person, they got right on it and had it fixed within 6 months. And there are many other requests that community groups have that are still pending. So data helps neighborhood groups to really make their case, and it actually makes city action easier because our city council people then can say, you know, I'm doing this because the data, a group came to me with data, not because I have a particular, you know, personal interest in this group versus that. So it makes it easier for politicians and elected officials to act and be able to point to the evidence they're using for deciding to act. Small successes build interest and often lead to bigger successes. So we've had groups that have tried something small, gotten really excited about that, and moved on to bigger and better things. And addressing walkability can also gain media attention for organizations. We had a really tragic story in Chicago where a young woman was walking across the street, was hit by a city bus and killed, and her husband organized a group to call attention to how dangerous this intersection was, and they used our walkability assessment to do assessments on a lot of the intersections around, and that drew a lot of media attention. Obviously, the crash also drew a lot of media attention, but it was followed because the group was saying, we're also gathering data about other areas in the community. So it's been really exciting to see how organizations use the tool. So for more information on our walkability work, you can go to our website. We've actually, the tool's not up there right now because we're including crime and safety questions, and we're still working on the part two, the solutions, but it'll be back up very soon. Thanks for your attention.
Hi, everybody. My name's Phil, Health Equity Director for the American Heart Association. When I came to this, you're on the a lot you can go down. And also, if you guys have a chance, Dr. Becker, we are one of the partners of CLOG, and they do a fantastic job. I can't tell you how many organizations take a look at CLOGs and use them as a good model. Not only are they a great model, but they also bring a lot of organizations together. You guys know how hard it is sometimes. Work with your partner organizations, do kind of one thing, because we all know how to do it right. Dr. Becker and the team does a fantastic job in that, at least making sure we all don't fight and throw things at each other in the same room. So the impact. Anybody ever worked with the American Heart Association before? Anybody? Things that you guys have done, anything fun, anything bad, what have you guys done, anybody? Got fun of you. Perfect. And what's the state?
Massachusetts.
Anybody else?
We're kind of free.
Fun? What state?
Here.
Oh, great. Anybody else? This side, anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Very good, thank you very much. And anybody else? So, part of today's really presentation is working with a large organization like the American Heart Association. As one of the directors there, I'm surprised that people they don't know how to work with us. We kind of intimidate them, they kind of have the perception of who the American Heart Association is. We're pretty nice guys. Our fundraisers aren't all the time, but the good guys on the ground do a really great job. And what we really try to do is really try to build that bridge amongst our partners by talking to other people. So what we're trying to do is obviously improve the cardiovascular health of all Americans by 20%, while at the same time making sure we avoid death amongst Americans. And for most of the time, we spend a lot of time with that part. And we really want to make sure to say, hey, this. We don't want you guys to die. For you guys who are doing all right, you've got to keep working hard. So let's prove that. We took a look at greater risk, greater deaths, everybody will tell you this month, our African-American Latino populations, back deaths across cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer across the board. I don't think it should be anything new to anybody else. We see high rates of obesity within our Hispanic Latino populations. Mom's Mexican, so whenever I go back to Los Angeles and keep this trees going with that, and you guys know about chorizo, it's probably one of the worst things you can eat, but I love it. And then African-Americans, we see high rates of blood pressure, hypertension, high numbers of stroke within them as well. So these are things that we have to deal with working within our multicultural populations. Some of the things that we want to really do is we take a look at a couple different areas, blood pressure, obesity, and eating better, and we're really trying to lower some of these numbers. So number one, it's lowering these numbers. Number two is measuring this. So the Heart Association can work with your organization and setting up some of these metrics for us to be able to kind of move people to see how we've been able to do that. And you guys know the game plan. Without being able to measure it, it really doesn't count. So that's what we do really fast. End of the day, we're a science-based organization that does a lot of research. You know, you guys have known a lot of our research. But if you can't kind of measure it, can't show it, to us it doesn't exist. So what the Heart Association is able to do is to really create this health equity partner. It's kind of what I do. Partners, multicultural populations, and try to figure out a systemic way to kind of make things better. And hopefully you guys are into some of these states that are in red, because we have dedicated staff into these states that are dedicated to working with you guys exclusively. Listening to kind of what your organization kind of does. Now, we can't do everything, all right? Can't do everything, but we can do a lot of things. We can bring resources, we can bring science, we can try to bring some finance times, try to bring some advocacy stuff. And you guys do it, I'm pretty sure you guys do it. But sometimes we just have other methods that can improve and enhance what you guys do. Any guys in states that are not colored right now? I just kind of want to invite you to show hands. Of loose. Anybody in any other states that you guys get them? Blue state? with a lot of different organizations, especially in our multicultural communities. All of our partners that we have, organizations, government sites, even media, that's all part of the game plan. We take a look at some of our other partners, AKs, LINX, Black Men's Association. So at the end of the day, we try to really kind of share one mission, one focus, and kind of agree upon trying to focus on that together. And hopefully, we can get a couple different things. It means sharing resources. Sometimes it means using their staff as spokespeople. Sometimes it means going out together and getting money. Now, that's important. I was going to work for a government organization. Money's important, right? You guys know that. So sometimes the best intentions can't go anywhere without any cash. So that's why we work together to try to raise cash together. Try to figure out what you guys want to do. Does it make sense? Is it heart-related? Is it heart-related? And then let's make this happen together. We got to play the media game. Now, I'm not a media guy. I'm a public health guy. I'm a psych guy. I like cats and motorcycles, too. But what I know about this is you have to be able to get some impressions. You got to be able to do the social media stuff. You got to be able to do the news stories and all that fun things. So here's just some of the things. These numbers really don't mean much to me, but it means a lot to somebody else. So take a look at that. When we work together, we focus on these kind of different media streams to kind of get whatever our messages are across. And we do a pretty decent, well, a good job with them. So let's talk about building healthy environments. So now kind of we're starting to put stuff together. We're trying to see what's going on. Just a couple stats for you guys. I mean, end of the day, we have high hypertension, under obesity. You guys pretty much know that. Children, obesity. Once again, things you guys know. Next slide. So we're going to kind of focus on three different areas that we really want to get going on. Sugar and sweet beverages. So the Heart Association has been really focusing on what can we do. And I want you guys to pay attention, listen to your organization, say, yeah, we're trying to do something with sugar sweetened beverages. We're trying to do that in our organization, our city, our township, our government, our state. The Heart Association wants to focus on this. What can we do to lower the amount of sugar sweetened beverages you guys drink, I drink, our kids drink? And then what can we do to get more water people can? For the most part, everybody okay on that one? Anybody really don't like that idea? Because there have been people who say, what are you doing here? I mean, hey, somebody said can't go golfing on Sunday, I can't get bent out of shape too, right? But at the end of the day, I think American Heart Association, so you guys get on that, we'll be in good shape. Sodium reduction. So I'm from Los Angeles, came to Chicago in 97. Two things I realized when I came to Chicago. Anybody been to Chicago? You guys been to Chicago, right? I noticed a couple things. Number one, people were still smoking in bars and restaurants in Chicago. So that was the first thing. I couldn't smoke in California since, I think, 95. Second thing is I couldn't believe how much salt people were throwing on their food, man. They were just throwing salt left and right. So we're trying to do this. We're trying to make sure people understand some of our recommendations and guidelines to obviously affect hypertension. And salt reduction is what we're trying to take a look at. In schools, city council meetings, anywhere that we have a lot of mass food generation, especially schools, I think that's a big deal. We're trying to work on that. And then physical activity. So American Heart Association, a lot of organizations also recommend 30 minutes most days of the week. 150 minutes, 30 minutes a day. So that's what we're trying to take a look at. Illinois is one of the few states, if not the only state, that mandates PE, but there's a lot of ways out of that. Get your little waiver, and school district, you know, doesn't have to do PE for kids. There's a lot of other things going on right now. They're all starting to push, like CPR in the states. I think Minnesota just recently passed something along those lines. Illinois has done that. But physical activity is something that we want to make sure that everybody's able to do, especially our young folks. Get them active, get them moving, give them a shot to counteract some of the other things that we can't do in the state system. So my point is this, with these three things, is what we're taking a look at. That's what we can pump our resources on. That's what we can save to try to get some money together. That's how we can go ahead and talk to some of our politicians and people who help us make these decisions to make these happen. Those are the things we can get stories on the media, so we can together do some of those things. Just really quick, is there any organization, just one or two real quick, that focus on that? Your guys, anybody you guys work on any of these three things? Anybody can say anybody? Just down, what do you do? What organization work on? Done on Friday night, full good restaurants. I know So we've got that available for you guys. And the great thing about it is you guys create it, community members create it, your organization's created it, it's on there. Kind of gives us a little bit more good details on what's going on here. Free to anybody to use, but the Heart Association kind of takes care of it, manages it, making sure it's good and available for everybody else that's going on. Just some screenshots of what we got going on. Gives you an idea. We have also the mobile app that sometimes works, sometimes does not. There's so many updates on your iPhones and Androids. Now, I'm personally a BlackBerry guy, so if anybody's still looking at my BlackBerry, I love it. But there's so many updates going on with this. But once again, the whole idea is this, especially for our younger population, that these are things that they're using, these are things that they live and breathe by on a daily basis. Let's come to them. Instead of people coming to the American Heart Association, let's come to them to see what they use. So, we, like Dr. Becker talked about also, when we take a look at walking paths, we take a look at a couple different things. Is it safe? Obviously, well lit. Is it long routes, cars? We want to make sure nobody gets hurt on these paths. Also, we want to take a look at their organizations or their groups that can help us kind of create, coordinate, and kind of roll these out sometimes. I mean, we have a story in Blue Island, a city in South Chicago that's been working with us to kind of get this squared away. Next slide, Peter. And then also, can we get signage? Can we get something along those lines? We've seen some temporary walking paths. We've seen the best walking paths actually at corporations. So if you work at like a Chase Bank in Chicago or some of the bigger companies that we have that have a large campus, they have no problem putting up these walking sites for the employees. So they walk during lunch, it's well lit, it's closed, everything's no problem. I think what happens when we try to go into our communities, the real world, the cities that we live in, that's when the real world issues kind of kick in. That's when costs kind of kick in, and that's when things kind of go a little tougher. And then hopefully we like to do kickoff ceremonies for everything. So hopefully you guys are able to get a nice walking path squared away. I mean, by the media. Try to show up the big work that you guys do. It's a good time for everybody. And then website, we talk about all that fun stuff. Next slide, yeah. So we talk about City of Blue Island. City of Blue Island, actually that's where Gina and I actually met. First suburb south of Chicago. Progressive little town. Very diverse, about 40% Latino. Maybe 30-35% African American. Mayor Vargas wanted to meet with American Heart Association. He said, "Hey guys, I want this to be a great town. I want to take care of my residents. I've got to figure out what we've got to do to kind of do this. And you guys are the gold standard. So we're going to partner with you guys. What can we do to do something internally with our government, number one? What can we do something with our residents to make sure things work out for them? And number three, what can we do to make our businesses profitable and healthy?" Ever heard this before? And you know, our Chicago jokes, that's never happened in Chicago. So I was really excited to do this, and we kind of talked about some of these things. These are things that we wanted to really focus on. Community gardens and schools, school systems, policy, active transport, stormwater management. It's not really our thing, but we'll listen. And then blood health prevention, cardiovascular health. So those are things that we can help. We try to figure things out, and we're still in the process. But the one thing that we've been able to really do that I'm very, very proud of is we're pretty much at the final stage of this walking path campaign. So essentially what we're trying to take a look at, they have public transportation, so obviously people are coming to Blue Island, commuting by public transportation, they got great parks, great school districts. What we're trying to do is simply this, there's seldom words within Blue Island. American Heart Association is dedicated cash and time and resources to going into, I think it's three words this year, two words next year, maybe two words next year, to be able to set these walking paths, quarter mile, which is a quarter of half. So that residents can actually measure, walk, and see how much they're moving on a daily basis. So right now, I think they've wrapped up where we're going to do it. They're just going to make sure that we can go ahead and put the signs in so we can get those squared away. But essentially, after year number one, we're going to have these signs that tell people every quarter mile how far you walk. And then we're going to hopefully get that in seven different wards. And that will be the first city in the state of Illinois, and has to be amongst the first 5-10 cities in the United States, be able to do that. Now what's costing? Right, because it's the same message cheap. We're very lucky that City of Blue Island, because our partners are out, be able to kind of take that installation, putting up the signs, they're kind of measuring, they got the little people, little wheelie things. Yeah, it's cool. I'm gonna do it. It's cold outside. We're gonna work on them with the signs. Signs cost anywhere between $100 to $200. Times four signs, because we need to go 4 miles. So four times seven is we're doing seven more. So that's 28 signs. So roughly about $3,000 is something we've got to come up with. $3,000, I'm not going to make any change about that, but $3,000 to be able to affect, about 25,000 people. And to me, that's one heck of a fantastic investment we can do to be able great things. Hopefully we'll walk them towards landmarks, business districts, places of church, parks and recs that are already there, naturally built environmental things that we can continue drawing people to. So that's kind of the kind of putting this together. If you guys have any questions, let me know. And once again, let me also have you guys give yourselves a round of applause since you guys are the real heroes. I'm just a hero of the guys. Thank you guys.
Gita, the next time we do this, I don't want to follow Phil, because that's hard to, tough act to follow. Hey, everybody, my name is Scott Ulrich again. I'm kind of the odd man out on this panel. I'm not from Chicago. I'm from Columbus, Ohio, so OH. And I'm not a public health professional, or so I thought. I'm an urban planner. I've been working in public health world only for about a year now, but it wasn't until I actually started working for a health department that I realized that I've always been working on public health issues, from land use to active transportation and open space planning. So I'm really happy to be here. This is my first year at APHA. Really happy to be here to talk about some of the creative walking programs and strategic partnerships that we formed at Columbus Public Health. So the Healthy Places program, a little bit about the program I manage at Columbus Public Health. It was created in 2006. And I've only been there for a year, so I can't take credit for any of this stuff. So it was created in 2006 in response to a lot of the mounting evidence and research that was developing at that time around the built environment and public health, how where you live has a profound impact on your health. So our mission at the Healthy Places program is to promote development practices that reduce negative health impacts and create places that foster physical activity in daily life, and is staffed by an urban planner, myself, and a health educator, working on place-based interventions to reduce chronic disease in our community and improve health equity. Our chronic disease section at the department is actually partnered up with a health equity section, which is all kind of newly created, and it's been a really exciting new experience for all of us to work together on that. And at the time that this program was created, it was kind of one of the only of its kind. There were a few here and there across the country, but more and more we're seeing this. And in fact, the state of Ohio this year, the Ohio Department of Health, has created a Healthy Places Coordinator, kind of modeled on our program to push this not only at the state level, but across communities throughout Ohio to advocate these types of built environment changes. What I like to say is our program kind of takes a combined top-down and bottom-up approach to this. So I work as an urban planner on more of the policy and environmental change side of it to make the city better for walking and biking. And then our health educator manages a set of walking and biking programs at the grassroots level to kind of drive that cultural change from the bottom up to encourage people to walk and bike more. So first I'm going to talk about some of those walking programs that form the bottom-up approach. So I'm not going to talk a long time about walkability assessments because Dr. Becker kind of covered that. But this is one of the main things we do with neighborhoods where we kind of examine and evaluate the built environment for walking. We do this in four neighborhoods per year through the mayor's Neighborhood Pride program. And we also take requests from other neighborhoods kind of on an as-requested basis as our capacity allows. And again, it's very similar to what Dr. Becker described, kind of a survey-based tool to identify barriers to walking and opportunities for improving the walking experience in the neighborhood. And again, we like to emphasize that this is a community-driven process. We are out there to facilitate the process, but to facilitate discussions. But what we really want is to teach the neighborhood participants how to be critical observers of their environment so that they can take the results and be their own advocates for change, because we just don't have the capacity, with all the neighborhoods we touch, to hold each one of their hands throughout the process. So at the end of the walk audit, we develop kind of a summary report of what we found And a lot of the recommendations that we came to agree on of how it can be improved. And then we also give them a guide of working through the city's bureaucratic processes, how they can request those changes, whether it's traffic calming or getting sidewalks repaired or installed, things like that. But the other outcome, in addition to that report, is we create a neighborhood walking map, very similar to what Phil was talking about with the neighborhood walking paths. So the audit report that we develop is obviously all the places that need improvement, but we want to show them where they can start walking right now, because those improvements could take years or even decades in some cases to get done. So we make sure to include points of interest like parks, recreation centers, schools, and libraries, and we create routes of different lengths for people of different abilities. And then we distribute the maps throughout the community and all those community centers and on our website where people can access them anytime and get walking. We've actually now created walking maps for almost 50 neighborhoods throughout Columbus, everywhere from the historic central neighborhoods in the inner city to some more suburban subdivisions. And it gets, each kind of place comes with its own set of issues that we have to address. Another set of walking maps that we put together is Columbus Art Walks, which has been really successful. These maps are designed to highlight things like public art and architecture and historical landmarks throughout the city, all laid out on convenient walking routes. Each site along the route is numbered on the map, and we also install custom branded signage at each site, so it's easy for walkers to find. And once they get there, they can call a phone number and get an audio, kind of like at a museum, if you ever call the audio number at a museum to get a more in-depth description of what you're looking at. We do that for all these sites. And we also have a text version on a mobile app so that, if somebody's hearing impaired, they can choose the mobile app version to read the data, or if they're sight impaired, they can use the audio version. While these are meant to be self-guided, we also provide a summer walking program that's guided through thanks to Columbus Landmarks Foundation, and they capture so much more information about these sites that we could ever capture, so there's definitely an added value element in them being involved, and so that program wouldn't exist if not for them, as well as the Greater Columbus Arts Council and the Ohio Humanities Council, which provided funding for that. And this year we were really excited to turn these, we have 13 of these Art Walks maps, and we turned them into 4 bike routes, because obviously you can cover more ground on a bike, so we consolidated them. And since we have a new bike share system in Columbus, there was a lot of demand for new themed rides and things like that, and we've gotten a lot more involved through our program in bike planning, so we wanted to get involved with that. So that's been a big change this year, and we led a few guided rides. They're also involved some bike safety education in those tours. So really cool opportunity there that we're excited to move forward in the coming years. Who's heard of Walk with a Doc? I have no idea how popular this program is. All right, so a few of you, but not everybody. So this is the newest addition to our walking programs, is the Walk with the Doc Walking Clubs. And Walk with the Doc is a free program. It's like other walking clubs, except we partner with local hospitals to get doctors to come out and give a short talk about whatever health or wellness topic that they want to talk about for 5 or 10 minutes, and then they walk for an hour in neighborhood parks. And we've worked with Mount Carmel Hospitals and OSU Medical Center in Columbus to provide the doctors at 4 walk locations throughout Columbus, one each on the north, south, east, and west sides. And we focused on obviously city parks with walking paths that we can use. My program actually received capital funds from the city this year to install free outdoor fitness equipment, fitness stations we call them, at 2 parks, and we actually chose specifically to install those fitness stations at Walk with the Doc parks, so that we have kind of a built-in stream of people who are going to be at that park and walking, and we can expose them to additional kinds of physical activity so they can balance their walking activity with some more weight-based activities. So that was you know, what we do from the ground up. Like I said, the walking programs. Now I want to talk a little bit about how much time did we get? Okay, about some of the top-down things that I do more throughout the city for a kind of policy system and environment change. So our work with walking programs led naturally into bike programs. So first we were offered a seat at the city's Bicycle Advisory Committee table, which provides input on everything from infrastructure design to education and encouragement campaigns. And then, like I mentioned, in 2013, we launched our bike share system called Kogo. And we play a key role on the steering committee for that. And as that system expands, right now it's just in our downtown area, but as it expands into some of those neighborhoods that touch downtown, we want to bring a focus on equity to those conversations so that the neighborhoods that need something like bike share as a transportation option the most are thought of and have the best access to nearby stations and discounted memberships, all of which is in the works. I know places like Boston have done things like discounted memberships, and that's a really growing conversation within the bicycle community is bike equity, and health equity is a big partner in that conversation. And now the city has seen the critical role that health can play in active transportation throughout our, you know, 8 years of this program's existence. Now they've asked us to play the role of bike and pedestrian coordinator for the city. So that means coordinating all of the interdepartmental work that goes with bike and pedestrian planning, the silo busting activities that takes. So that just kind of shows how great it can work out having health involved in active transportation planning. Complete streets is something I think most of us are already aware of. You know, we're focused on rebalancing our streets to accommodate all types of users, including bicycle pedestrians, transit riders, and motorists. And obviously one of the steps that many communities have taken is adopting a complete streets policy that formalizes that commitment to accommodating all road users every time they rebuild or repave a street. One step that not so many communities have taken, the next step in that process, is integrating that type of thinking into their actual transportation planning. So creating new street design manuals, new performance metrics that evaluate service for all different users, and assigning priority levels for those different travel modes in different corridors. So saying this is going to be a pedestrian priority corridor, this is going to be a bike priority corridor, or a transit priority corridor. A few communities have done that, and Columbus, I'm happy to say, is going to be pursuing that type of plan in the next 2 years or so. It's going to be a long road ahead of us with our multimodal thoroughfare plan, but it's going to be really exciting. That vehicle level of service is not going to drive all of our thinking from here on out. And one thing that I'm going to be pushing for, because I guess I feel like my job in whatever room I'm in is always to be pushing. It's great that they're taking this step, but what else can I be pushing for? And so I've kind of written, moving beyond movement here is I don't want them to just be thinking about, you know, so many times transportation conversations are just about transportation and not about public spaces, and we forget that streets are our biggest public space in almost any city. And they should be for whatever public purpose that, you know, we want to use them for. And sometimes we just need a place to sit, and there's either not enough sidewalk there or there's not a park nearby. So one step that a lot of different cities have taken, and I think Chicago is among them, you know, rededicating space from cars to people. And this is in the form of plazas, or everybody heard of parklets, where you take a parking space and turn it into a public space. What are they calling them in Chicago? People spaces, yeah. So call it whatever you want. It's public space, and it's great. And I want to make sure that that's one of the tools that we add to our transportation toolbox as part of this process. Along with that is open streets. How many people have heard of open streets? Awesome. So open streets are events where streets are closed to traffic and open to pretty much everyone else. So walking, biking, rollerblading, yoga classes, fitness classes, climbing walls, sandcastles, anything you can think of besides vehicle travel
And to allow people to experience the street in a new way, to help them see streets as public spaces and the potential they hold for doing more than just moving cars. So the picture on the left is an open streets event in San Francisco. So it gives you an idea that even in one of the most walkable cities in the world, there's still a latent demand for public space, for walking, for biking. And on the right, you can see kind of a sticker activity where people who attended an open streets event put a sticker on the activity that they did during their stay at the open streets. And you can see the majority of the dots are in biking and walking. So although there's a lot of physical activity that happens at open streets, it's more about the cultural change that it drives within the community and creating advocates and champions within the community for demanding more out of your infrastructure. And I'm happy to say that Columbus hosted its very first Open Streets event. It was long overdue this year. Columbus Public Health was able to provide some funding to the nonprofit organizers, and I was able to participate on the planning committee. And it went so well that people were demanding that next year or the years after a monthly or quarterly event. So we're going to have to see how we can pull that off. It may not be next year, but that's definitely something to shoot for in the future. And we were able to gather really important data, like how many people attended, how long did they stay, and most importantly, how much would they spend if how much money they would spend if the open streets had taken place on a business corridor. We did it on kind of a side street this year just to make it easy to do and as little resistance as possible, but we were able to get some really good data so that next year we can push and say, hey, this isn't going to kill your business for this day. It's going to make it better, and all these people are going to come and spend money at your business. So data gathering is really an important thing to do at these, particularly if you're just trying it out as a pilot process. Community design review is one of the things I do in my position as an urban planner, which is a public health intervention in our zoning process. I think everyone knows that zoning, you know, is the what guides land use change in our community. It tells you what you can do with your property and how it has to be laid out on the site. So it shapes how things are designed on our land. And so we launched this program in 2007, just went to our Department of Building and Zoning Services and asked to be at the table to be a staff reviewer of all development proposals that come in to the city. And so we make educational recommendations that are actually encourage private developers to voluntarily go above and beyond what's in the code to improve their building site, to strengthen their projects by increasing active living features. And it's been an incredibly successful process. In 2009, they were rewriting the parking code and actually took a lot of the things we were recommending month after month and just wrote them into the code. So now bike parking is required. A pedestrian connection from the sidewalk to the front door is required, and it baffled me that wasn't already required, that they were required to put in a sidewalk but not to connect it to the front door. I thought that was crazy. So it's given us an opportunity, now that those things are codified, we have had to get creative. So like I said, pushing to the next step, to the next level, what else can we be asking for? So now in multifamily housing sites, we're asking for a walking route around the entire site. Or if it's built right, if it backs right up to a strip center or a retail center, they can put in a pedestrian connection even if there's not going to be a vehicular connection. Even things like seating and public art, texturized sidewalks that make it a little bit safer for crossing the street, all those kinds of things. And that kind of led straight into health impact assessment. And I'm not sure how many people are familiar with health impact assessment. That's awesome. That's really good to see that it's becoming more and more familiar for everybody. So this is where we look at proposed plans, projects, and policies to kind of determine whether it'll have a positive or negative impact on community health, and it's our opportunity to influence decision-making. So it's one tool in a health and all policies approach. I didn't know that was going to be next year's theme, but I'm going to have to put some together for that. So we asked ourselves, if we're doing this for zoning and we're doing this for development projects, why can't we do it for other things? So we talked to our neighborhood planning division and established a partnership with them to review all their neighborhood plans, which are land use plans, long-range plans for all the neighborhoods in the city, made active living recommendations, and all of those, most of those recommendations that, again, we were making plan after plan, they've just integrated it into their kind of best practice guidelines that they put in all their plans now. So right now we're doing an HIA on a district-wide safe routes to school travel plan that's going to impact all 95 schools, elementary and middle schools in the Columbus City School District. And that's where I've seen that it's been a tool not just for getting health into the considerations of a project, but actually breaking down barriers and establishing organizational relationships where there hadn't been. Anyone who's worked with a school district probably knows that it's, you know, they've built up their barriers over the years. They've got their own bureaucratic processes. I mean, it can be just as bad as a regular governmental entity. So where we didn't have relationships before, now we have them just because of this process, because we've been talking to them throughout this plan. And I guess that's my cue to wrap up pretty quick here. But again, we're seeing this, just like everything else that I've been talking about, kind of working itself out of a job. Instead of coming in at the end of the process and telling them what the health impacts are going to be and asking them to change it after the fact, we're being asked now to come in at the beginning of a project or plan so that we're just at the table the whole time. We don't have to do an HIA. We're just there and providing feedback, constant, consistent feedback throughout the process. Physical activity prescriptions, I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this. This is not something we're doing now, but it's something we want to pursue. I know it's big in Chicago. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but they're putting together these informal prescription pads that some doctors can actually write a referral, and the patients can actually get a free subscription to the fitness centers, all the city's fitness centers throughout the recreation, parks and recreation system. So I think that's fantastic, and I think we're looking at how we can do that and how we can also wrap that into some of the bike share discounted memberships. If we're giving them a free or discounted membership to a rec center, why can't we also give them a bike share membership? So looking at what that prescription pad looks like, what healthcare system interventions we can fit that into is kind of, I think, the next frontier in our program. And I'll just kind of sum it up with our philosophy, whether you call it built environment and community health or healthy community design, I like to call it building a healthy human habitat. And I think we all have a role to play in building a healthy human habitat, whether you're in a nonprofit setting or a national organization like Phil or a local health department like me. So that's it for me. Thank you.
Well, thank you to everyone. Thanks for coming again, and thank you to my wonderful panelists. I don't know about you, but I thought this was a great presentation. It really showed fine examples of three organizations that are committed to changing public health, the public health landscape, improving our communities, and really using and leveraging the power and the value of community capital in addressing health disparities. I learned a lot. I thank you again. And we'd like to take this time to open up for discussion or for any questions. And happy to hear about some local things that are going on around some of the topics that we discussed, or even just questions for us.
One of the things I guess I didn't talk about, but usually when we talk about the genesis of the program, it had a lot to do with just our health commissioner listening to a lot of the guidance that was coming out of APHA, CDC, and the American Planning Association all kind of coalescing around the built environment and health back in, I wasn't paying attention back then, so I'm just going to say 2005, 2006, when all that kind of stuff was coming out. And our neighborhood, or our planning division director had retired that year, and they brought him on kind of as a consultant to look at all that evidence and say, what would that look like in a health department? And he, that community design review process kind of drove a lot of the early work because that was what he knew. And I think I'm the third Healthy Places coordinator now, and we've all kind of added our touches over the way. And for a long time, it was just one person, and they did the walking programs and all those strategic partnerships. And it's only about a year old now that we've added a health educator to do the walking programs. I think that's, I mean, it's not only increased our capacity to just do more things, but I also just think that's a better fit for the work that's being done, because that's her wheelhouse, is going out and doing community engagement and educating about walking and how it improves health. And it's in my wheelhouse to kind of do the behind-the-scenes policy work. So if that answers your question.
And the dollars?
Huh?
Where does the money go?
It's all general fund. We got, yeah, it's all general fund. And that's what, it took time to kind of build the support to go from one person to two people. So that's the big hurdle to get over, is that's the political will to get that general fund money dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
A question also, Scott. Who does your health impact assessments, how do they get paid for, and do you have any partnerships with academic institutions in the community?
Yeah. it's a portion of what I do. Historically, it was just my physician doing health impact assessments. So they were traditionally very qualitative, very quick. We didn't have a whole lot of capacity. It was kind of on the fly. It has since grown to include our health equity section, our epidemiology section, to add a quantitative aspect to it, and our environmental health section and injury prevention. So it's now a very well-rounded by committee, and it pulls a piece of all of our time to do it. What were some of the other?
So it's paid for just through resources. There's no additional dollars.
There's no additional, and that's what we keep looking, we keep searching, because it's really hard to do it as, you know, by committee. In a piece of my time here and a piece of their time here, we need a coordinator. We really do, and that's what we're finding. It needs to be somebody's job to just lead that.
And partnerships with any of the academic institutions.
We've gone in on a couple grant proposals with Ohio State. They have a center for kind of equity and racial research. We want to bring them in and help out with the equity side of it. And we also have a nonprofit called Community Research Partners that we want to add to the quantitative side of it. We haven't gotten funded yet, but it's really hard to get everybody on board with no money attached to it. So I think that's our dream.
Did you have a question?
Do you have any relationship
with Local FDO? Yeah, we work closely with them. They're actually doing a regional active transportation plan right now, that we're using a lot of the lessons learned for that to drive what we're going to hopefully do with our multimodal thoroughfare plan. So there's a lot of support there in terms of active transportation.
And so you get that funding. My thinking is that you get that funding that can fill in some of the gaps in terms of assessment.
For infrastructure, yeah. And they're conducting an economic impact of trail study right now that's hopefully going to add one more tool to our toolbox to advocate for like off-street trails for active living.
Can I get more information on the prescription for exercise? So if they are given a prescription, does the health insurance company pay the city Parks and Rec, or how does that work exactly?
It might not be as accurate to call it a prescription as much as a referral. And a discount. It's more of just a referral-based system where they are given the prescription pad to give the discounts for individuals who have been identified for obesity risk and I think income eligible as well. So it's kind of that two-pronged income and health vulnerability
just the Chicago Park District, so yeah. It's not really funded. It's just a policy that they won't charge a fee. And they do still charge for kids, but it's nominal, because that's where most of their income comes from, is kids enrolling in Park District programs. So they haven't quite been able to have kids go for free, but it's definitely something that they're looking at.
Y'all, and maybe for other folks in here. I just started, I'm more of a monitoring evaluation kind of person, and I've been asked to help with an M&E on a kind of project, but in a very different context. These places seem to be a little bit more high density. The place I've been asked to work with has about 8,000 people in the county. It's a former Superfund site, and it has about 10,000 feet. I'm in Colorado. And they want to work on these kinds of, you know, healthy lifestyle activities. They don't even have a rec center, as far as I know. Do y'all have any suggestions? Very broadly, because that's kind of complicated, about how you may have approached this issue in the past, of not having these basic resources due to density and being willing to promote.
I mean, I could say, you know, the walkability assessment that we've designed, there are a lot of walkability audits out there. But we found they were, at least when we were looking, they're predominantly research-focused, so they're very technical. They require lots of different kinds of measures. The methodology is kind of, you know, how research is, rigorous, standardized. Lots of observers have to be at certain places. And then they were all just the diversity of the kinds of environments that they assumed you were in, because they were these sort of research-focused instruments. They really weren't that helpful for us. So we took those. Things like the Minnesota Irvine, I think, and there are a couple of others that we looked at, and just adapted them for the environments that we were going to be working in. So my suggestion would be to first, you know, do some focus group work with people in the community that you're going to be working in to see what kinds of places would they like to walk, but they probably can't, or bike. What do they see as some of the obstacles? And some of these tools had things that weren't appropriate for us, like, you know, big rivers and streams or high mountain ranges, which might be very appropriate for you. You know, so kind of thinking about tailoring it, and then, you know, our goal was to be able to put the data in the hands of community members, so then designing the tool in a way that it could be very easily used. So that's one place where you could start.
In the back.
My question is for Bill. So here we think the work would be
Yeah, absolutely. You'll always want to ask for a health equity staff. So health equity will be the ones that you want to take a look at. They'll be your liaison to take a look at that. What they'll probably want to do before we kind of elevate it to some of the national partnerships is to make sure we can have at least a year or two of success or working together within the local market. Find out who the leaders are, find out more about the organizations, try to take a look at the strengths and weaknesses of both to try to be able to fill in some of the gaps that we have. Once we've been able to kind of identify those successes, then we can kind of push it on to see if there's other affiliates. American Heart Association is throughout all 50 states, but they break us off into smaller affiliates just to kind of maintain it. So in the Midwest, we're the Midwest affiliate of 11 states, which, by the way, are the best in the United States. But depending on where you're at, they're a smaller group. I think in the Southwest, it's Texas, Arizona, Oklahoma, and maybe New Mexico. So that's kind of how they do it. Western states, pretty much everything on the West Coast. So depending on how your affiliate is, they'll take a look at what it is. And if not, sometimes if you're not in those red states and they're within that group of affiliates, sometimes they'll try to be able to kind of match you with that director there. So, for example, we talked about Indiana. So, oddly enough, I'm the director of Northwest Indiana. If you're down in Indianapolis, they say, hey, Phil, maybe you could kind of do a connection there and try to figure something out to see what we can do. So that's kind of how we try to partner with it and try to make it work. But here, at the end of the day, I think we want to see successes. We want to be able to see success and growth in your organization as well. So we try our best to really just make sure it's a win-win for both groups. And all the groups up there that we've listed are now national partners because we've been able to show how both organizations have grown on a local level. And then also staff and members of those organizations be able to contribute to the opposite organization as well. So it's not always a give. We're also trying our best to give our resources, our healthcare providers who are volunteers, the things that we have internally, we'll try to give to that organization as well to make things happen. We're very, very proud of some of our sororities that we have. Delta Sigma Theta, Alpha Kappa Alpha, they've been fantastic supports for the American Heart Association and World of Stroke. The Mexican consul has been fantastic in the world, and the National Alliance of Hispanic Nurses has been fantastic in the world of Latino health. So we continue to try to find those means to kind of find different ways to make the mission move.
I mean, for us, it kind of depends on the goal. So if you're using it, which we've done, to monitor change, then depending on the kind of change you're looking for, you might have to wait years. If you're just doing it for communities to identify baseline challenges that they want to change, you could do one every day, you know, on a different block. So it's sort of, they're really highly, the one we have is just highly tailorable. You can use it for a variety of purposes in a variety of contexts, and it's really up to the, you know, to the partnership to figure out, like, what's going to make the most sense. But I think if you're looking at it to measure change in the environment over time, and you expect some of those changes to be things like new traffic calming infrastructure, better sidewalks, that it can take a long time if the money isn't right there sitting there waiting.
Scott, this is actually a question about Columbus, Ohio. The Eastland neighborhood does not have a safe place for residents to exercise or center. This is because it wasn't designed initially. It was designed a long, long time ago for an industrial area. So what's your approach? I'll be talking to you.
All right.
We start a broader conversation. I mean, I think we try to understand your needs and where you're coming from and kind of the history behind it. And then I think we start, depending on what the issues are, whether it's just safe places to exercise or whether it's safe places to walk and bike, both. So starting conversations with Parks and Recreation Department and Public Service Transportation Department as to, you know, what have we done, what hasn't worked, what has worked, and what are the opportunities for intervention? Because sometimes there's just no, if they just got done doing the plan, the neighborhood plan a few years ago, it's not going to be updated again, so what can we do without that? If there's about to be a plan coming up that we can get some priorities set in, then notifying the planning division about that. But It kind of changes neighborhood to neighborhood. Whatever the issues are, we try to respond kind of on the fly. We don't have a set process for dealing with that. But yeah, talk to me anytime.
I know your question was about Columbus, but I think more generally, what I've seen to work in Chicago as being outside of government, the Chicago Department of Transportation got really engaged around this kind of work by looking at crash data. So they were really focused on pedestrian safety. Use pedestrian crash data to identify priority spots across the city where they would do what they call safety zones. The Department of Planning and Development in the city was really interested in land use and land use for recreation. So they actually did a study on acres of parkland or green space per capita. So they set a norm as a city that they would hope, you know, all Chicagoans would live within X number of miles or percentage of a mile from a green space, and then did a study of all the neighborhoods and looked at where those priority areas were. So in a community where the government isn't doing that stuff, if the communities can find those data, put those data together and talk to the media, get attention around, you know, this is a high crash zone, or, you know, this neighborhood has, you know, fewer acres per capita of parkland than anywhere else in the community, that speaks to public officials. And sometimes embarrasses them, and they say, "Okay, we gotta do something about this because they're getting way too much attention." But it sounds like you've got a city that's focused, so that's good.
But that's a great point of the difference between what the city can do and what outside partners can do, because I can only do so much. I can't go that extra step in terms of that, you know, a lot of that advocating and upsetting people. I'd like to upset people to a certain extent, but only to a certain extent. We try to hand it off to someone else at that point.
I worked on the west side of Chicago, and I worked very closely with the new police commander, who was very interested in participating in these Saturday walking groups. That it was mostly women out walking, but it was through a pretty sketchy area in the Austin community on the west side, and we had a police presence that, you know, she was very interested in physical activity and having people not scared to leave their homes to come out. So and 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning sometimes is good for all the people who have done the bad in the nighttime. They're still sleeping at 7. So we worked out a good time. We had police that, you know, had some time on their hands a little bit and were also interested in participating in the group. And so we kind of collaborated that way, too. And that was without having to go through all the red tape. I mean, I don't know if that was, she made the call for me, which was great. But I was working with a community-based organization and approached the police department sort of as a last ditch. And it worked. Any other questions? Comments? Ramos Fizz? No, just kidding. Trying to go really local here. All the drinks, all the food, and all the walking. And I'm walking back to the French Quarter if anybody wants to join me after this. Well, thank you again for coming, and thanks for all of your valuable contributions. Thank you to the panel. We'll see you next year in Chicago.